Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy. Soren Kierkegaard, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 4.
Most Danes had little doubt about where the Lutheran State Church stood in the conflict between the aesthetic and the ethical. In fact, Judge William frequently appeals to Bible passages, invokes the name of God, and refers to official church ceremonies, such as weddings and baptisms, to explain and defend the ethical way of life. But Kierkegaard himself refused to identify the religious with the ethical. He posited a separate and distinctive religious existence. A later autobiographical work makes it clear that even at the time he wrote Either-Or, the ethical form of existence was not a viable option for Kierkegaard.
I was so deeply shaken that I understood perfectly well that I could not possibly succeed in striking the comforting and secure middle way in which most people pass their lives. I had either to cast myself into perdition and sensuality, or to choose the religious absolutely as the only thing. Either the world in a measure that would be dreadful, or the cloister.
Kierkegaard's most famous work, Fear and Trembling, was written soon after Either-Or, also under a pseudonym. In this work, he dramatically distinguishes between ethical and religious existence with an unblinking examination of the Old Testament story of Abraham and Isaac. The pseudonymous author of Fear and Trembling, Johannes de Silentio, opens the book by recounting his lifelong obsession with the biblical story.
Once upon a time, there was a man who, as a child, had heard that beautiful story of how God tempted Abraham, and of how Abraham withstood the temptation, kept the faith, and contrary to expectation, got a son a second time. When he grew older, he read the same story with even greater admiration, for life had fractured what had been united in the pious simplicity of the child. The older he became, the more often his thoughts turned to that story. His enthusiasm for it became greater and greater, and yet he could understand the story less and less. Finally, he forgot everything else because of it. His soul had but one wish, to see Abraham, but one longing, to have witnessed that event. His craving was not to see the beautiful regions of the East, not the earthly glory of the promised land, not that God-fearing couple whose old age God had blessed, not the venerable figure of the aged patriarch, not the vigorous adolescence God bestowed upon Isaac. The same thing could just as well have occurred on a barren heath. His craving was to be present in that hour when Abraham raised his eyes and saw Mount Moriah in the distance, the hour when he left the asses behind and went up the mountain alone with Isaac. For what occupied him was not the beautiful tapestry of the imagination, but the shudder of the idea.
Johannes shudders at the idea that Abraham is at once the father of faith and yet in moral terms a murderer. To explain his apparent contradiction, it's not enough to point out that in the end Abraham sacrifices a ram. Abraham's already shown that he's prepared to obey God's command to sacrifice his son. He's passed the trial of his faith because he's willing to go through with the murder. According to Johannes, we're confronted by an uncomfortable dilemma. We must stop referring to Abraham as the father of faith and condemn him as a murderer, or we must acknowledge that we can legitimately ignore ethical rules to obey a command of God. To sharpen the strange and troubling character of the Abraham story, Johannes de Silentio contrasts it with cases of other parents compelled by duty to kill their children. For example, he cites the case of the Greek king Agamemnon, who sacrificed his daughter Iphigenia to obtain favorable winds for his army to sail to Troy. Here, the father violated his ethical duty to his daughter to fulfill a supposedly higher ethical duty to his country. Agamemnon doesn't ignore or suspend his ethical obligations. He chooses one particular ethical duty over another. For Abraham, no higher ethical duty demands his son's death. No moral obligation overrides his duty to his son. His religious duty to God is what must override other relevant moral obligations. This story calls into question the easy assimilation between the religious and the ethical that we saw in Judge William. Johannes de Silentio says that when ethics and religion are lumped together, the word God becomes an empty abstraction, which really means nothing more than ethical rules.
The ethical is the universal, and as such, it is also the divine. Thus, it is proper to say that every duty is essentially duty to God. But if no more can be said than this, then it is also said that I actually have no duty to God. The duty becomes duty by being traced back to God, but in the duty, I do not enter into relation to God. The whole existence of the human race rounds itself off as a perfect, self-contained sphere. And then the ethical is that which limits and fills at one and the same time. God comes to be an invisible vanishing point, an impotent thought. His power is only in the ethical, which fills all of existence.
To accept the existence of a real God, a God not identical to moral principles and rules, Johannes de Silentio says we must admit that God may command any action at any time. The view that God is not bound by ethical rules, but rather that he determines what's right and wrong, has evoked horrified and indignant responses from many readers of Fear and Trembling. The American philosopher Bran Blanchard speaks of Kierkegaard as a moral nihilist. He calls Fear and Trembling a rhapsody in 40,000 words in praise of pure and holy murder. Johannes de Silentio anticipated just such critiques. He replied as follows.
Is it possible to speak unreservedly about Abraham without running the risk that some individual will become unbalanced and do the same thing? If I dare not, I will say nothing at all about Abraham. And the last thing I will do is to scale him down in such a way that he thereby becomes a snare for the weak. As a matter of fact, if one makes faith everything, that is, makes it what it is, then I certainly believe that I dare to speak of it without danger in our day, which is scarcely prodigal in faith. It is only by faith that one achieves any resemblance to Abraham, not by murder. If it fell my lot to speak about him, I would begin by showing what a devout and God-fearing man Abraham was, worthy of being called God's chosen one. Only a person of that kind is put to such a test. But who is such a person? Next, I would describe how Abraham loved Isaac. For that purpose, I would call upon all the good spirits to stand by me, so that what I said would have the glow of fatherly love. I hope to describe it in such a way that there would not be many a father in the realms and lands of the king who would dare to maintain that he loved in this way. But if he did not love as Abraham loved, then any thought of sacrificing Isaac would surely be a spiritual trial. If such words were spoken, the result would be that some of the fathers would by no means demand to hear more, but for the time being would be pleased if they actually succeeded in loving as Abraham loved.
In a later passage, Johannes de Silentio spells out once again in quite vivid terms the great demands made of any person who would suspend ethical rules in favor of a religious authority.
In the moment he is about to sacrifice Isaac, the ethical expression for what he is doing is he hates Isaac. But if he actually hates Isaac, he can rest assured that God does not demand this of him, for Cain and Abraham are not identical. he must love Isaac with his whole soul. Since God claims Isaac, Abraham must, if possible, love Isaac even more. Only then can he sacrifice him. For it is indeed this love for Isaac that makes his act a sacrifice by its paradoxical contrast to his love for God.
After these conditions are made clear, Johannes wonders if anyone would still feel called to make sacrifices such as Abraham is prepared to make at Moriah. If so, then Johannes says he would saddle his horse and ride along, using every moment to encourage the father to turn back, to repent, to confess that it's all a grotesque misunderstanding. But is it really possible that anyone could pass the test Johannes proposes? Could anyone possess perfect fatherly love even in the terrible moment of the sacrifice? For that matter, who among imperfect humans could ever presume to have the sort of perfect love Johannes de Silentio credits to Abraham? It begins to appear that all this talk of suspensions of the ethical is moot, since no one could actually meet the conditions. That makes fear and trembling appear to be a sort of pointless mental experiment, a reflection on what might be in a world different from ours. But largely overlooked among Johannes de Silentio's reflections on Abraham is another story, the story of Agnes and the Merman. This other story may hold a clue to a different reading of the book. In Johannes's retelling of the fairy tale, Agnes, through her trusting innocence, wins the heart of the Merman, a demonic seducer who's previously lured maidens to their deaths in the sea. But for the Merman to restrain himself from seducing her is to lose her.
He can seduce Agnes. He can seduce 100 Agneses. He can make any girl infatuated. But Agnes has won, and the Merman has lost her. Only as booty can she be his. He cannot give himself faithfully to any girl, because he is indeed only a merman.
The merman is unable to commit himself to Agnes in the ethical institution of marriage. Johannes uses this story to symbolize a suspension of the ethical that's radically different from what we've seen in the case of Abraham. Abraham's righteousness, that is, his willingness to fulfill the demands of the law, makes possible a special individual relation to God. In this relationship, Abraham directly responds to God's mandates. But the merman stands outside the ethical because of his sins. Ethical rules are moot for someone who's already a sinner, someone who lacks the indispensable condition of moral innocence.
In sin, the single individual is already higher than the ethical, because it is a contradiction on the part of the ethical to want to demand itself from a person who lacks the indispensable condition.
Johannes is saying that once a person has sinned, he or she can't live the ethical form of existence. The moral law is absolute. Any transgression marks us as sinners. It strips us of the innocence required to fulfill its demands. Another Kierkegaard pseudonym, Vigilius Haufniensis, makes the same point in a work, The Concept of Anxiety.
Ethics points to ideality as a task, and assumes that every man possesses the requisite conditions. Thus, ethics develops a contradiction, inasmuch as it makes clear both the difficulty and the impossibility of fulfilling its demands. Sin belongs to ethics only insofar as upon this concept it is shipwrecked.
This suspension of the ethical, this inability to do right because we're fundamentally sinful, is the essential subtext in Fear and Trembling. Our dilemma is not that God will require us to break moral law, it's that we, through our own transgressions, make ourselves unable to lead the moral life which Judge William recommends so highly. This analysis of our moral impotence is confirmed and underlined in Repetition, another work that Kierkegaard published simultaneously with Fear and Trembling. Constantin Constantius, the pseudonymous author of Repetition, is an aesthete who's become friends with a young man. This young man's in love with a young lady who loves him in return. While no external impediments stand in the way, the young man finds himself unable to marry. This inability creates a sense of distance from his beloved. He seems to remember their love even when he's in the same room with her. So Constantine reflects on the unhappy condition of his young friend.
He was deeply and fervently in love, that was clear. And yet a few days later, he was able to recollect his love. He was essentially through with the whole relationship. In beginning it, he took such a tremendous step that he leaped over life. If the girl dies tomorrow, it will make no essential difference. What a curious dialectic. He longs for the girl. He has to do violence to himself to keep from hanging around her all day long. And yet, in the very first moment, he became an old man in regard to the entire relationship. Underneath it all, there must be a misunderstanding.
Since Constantine is an aesthete, he's not really able to help the youth get to the bottom of the misunderstanding. But the young man soon realizes that the problem's actually religious. He writes a series of letters to Constantine comparing his situation to that of Job's. He sees his strange detachment from his beloved, his reflective removal from her presence as a religious trial. But he's like the merman. Through sin, he has left the realm of the ethical, whether he recognizes it or not. He has but one hope. He must enter into a direct relation to the one power that can forgive sin and restore innocence, God. Johannes de Silentio had described in Fear and Trembling how to restore innocence.
When the single individual, by his guilt, has come outside the universal, that is, the ethical, he can return only by virtue of having come as the single individual into an absolute relation to the absolute.
In other words, Johannes says that human hope lies not in one's own accomplishment, but rather in the trusting acceptance of God's grace. We see this also in the ultimatum, the last and by far the shortest of Judge Williams' letters to A. It consists primarily of a sermon written by a pastor in Jutland, who's a friend of the judge. It's called The Upbuilding That Lies in the Thought That in Relation to God We Are Always in the Wrong. How strange for Judge William, an advocate of the ethical way of living, to send his friend a text saying that no matter how hard we strive, no matter how dedicated we are to fulfilling the demands of the law, we stand unavoidably and irretrievably before God. We are debtors needing grace rather than good servants awaiting pay. But is repentance the final word in human religious life? A second look at the Abraham story shows us it's not. While most critics have focused on Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his son, Johannes is astounded that Abraham is able to receive the boy back. Abraham loves him just as before, even after raising his knife to carry out the sacrifice. Try as he might, Johannes cannot understand how this could be. In fact, he opens the book with four separate imaginative recreations of the journey to Mount Moriah. One of these in particular illustrates how the experience could be expected to change Abraham forever.
It was early in the morning when Abraham arose. He embraced Sarah, the bride of his old age, and Sarah kissed Isaac, who took away her disgrace, Isaac her pride, her hope for all the generations to come. They rode along the road in silence, and Abraham stared continuously and fixedly at the ground until the fourth day, when he looked up and saw Mount Moriah far away. But once again he turned his eyes toward the ground. Silently he arranged the firewood and bound Isaac. Silently he drew the knife. Then he saw the ram that God had selected. This he sacrificed and went home. From that day henceforth, Abraham was old. He could not forget that God had ordered him to do this. Isaac flourished as before, but Abraham's eyes saw joy no more.
As Johannes de Silentio is the first to admit, this Abraham isn't the father of faith. The real Abraham is called that not because he gave up Isaac, but because he believed he'd get him back. This is the real distinguishing mark of Abraham, We see it in his actions when God commanded him to sacrifice Isaac.
But what did Abraham do? He arrived neither too early nor too late. He mounted his ass. He rode slowly down the road. During all this time, he had faith. He had faith that God would not demand Isaac of him, and yet he was willing to sacrifice him if it was demanded. He had faith by virtue of the absurd. For human calculation was out of the question, and it certainly was absurd that God, who required it of him, should in the next moment rescind the requirement. He climbed the mountain, and even in the moment when the knife gleamed, he had faith that God would not require Isaac. No doubt he was surprised at the outcome, but through a double movement, he had attained his first condition, and therefore he received Isaac more joyfully than the first time.
This is the end of part 4. Please download part 5 to continue.